Since March 19, 1979, C-SPAN, a public service funded by the cable television industry, began giving you direct access to government in an innovative way by putting you, the viewer, into the rooms where politics is debated and policies are determined. C-SPAN began as a bold initiative. Now, 45 years later, we are essential for those wanting to see democracy at work without editing or commentary. With continued cable support, we've done this without a dime of government funding, maintaining our independence. As we mark 45 years, the business of media is rapidly changing, and now your support is crucial for our mission's future. Support our legacy of unfiltered access by donating today at cspan.org/donate.
About the commies in the State Department. Do you think that they should be named and their names should be brought out in the open?
Well, my answer to that would be this. I think that the committees of Congress, the Committee on Un-American Activities on the House side, and the Judiciary Committee and other committees on the Senate side should investigate the charges of communism and communist fellow travelers within the State Department. And I think that the President should cooperate with those committees by turning over information regarding the loyalty checks which have been made by the administrative branch of the government. I think that they should take the initiative, and if their house is clean, they should not refuse to do, as they have refused in the past, to turn over the information to the Congress so that the Congress can investigate the facts and present the facts to the American people.
Oh, I think that's great.
Scott Eyman, that was Hedda Hopper, gossip columnist, and then Representative Richard Nixon from 1950 on the Hedda Hopper Show, talking about communists in America. Well, you open your new book, Charlie Chaplin Versus America, with a 1952 letter from Hedda Hopper to Senator Richard Nixon saying, quote, "Personally, I hope he goes and never comes back. He is as bad a citizen as we have in this country, as you well know." Why was Hedda Hopper writing to a U.S. senator about Charlie Chaplin?
Well, she wrote a lot of letters to Richard Nixon, actually. There are a number of files in the Nixon library. It could contain nothing but missives to and from Hedda Hopper. They had an interesting relationship. She had long been a supporter of his from the time when he was a congressman and supporting him when he was elected senator. And she was constantly haranguing him via mail about one problem or another that she saw as crucial to the survival of the Republic. And generally, he would write her placating letters, asserting that he agreed with everything she'd said, and he wished there were more citizens like her. And then he would do absolutely nothing about what she wanted him to do. He treated her basically like an annoying aunt at Thanksgiving, who tells you how to dress and how to vote and what shows to watch and what shows not to watch. And rather than get into a long disquisition that's only going to end in bad feelings, you acquiesce to her and then go on about your business because she's not going to be there. So that's essentially the way Nixon treated her. He would say, "Yes, you're absolutely right, Hedda," and then nothing would happen. And she seems not to have actually noticed that often. On the other hand, he didn't really want to antagonize her because she had a vast readership through the Los Angeles Times Syndicate, as well as radio appearances and television appearances. So he had to keep her on his side of the aisle, as it were. And he did. He did. She never really wavered in her support for him publicly. Privately, she would complain mightily when her letters and her concerns were not dealt with. But it was an interesting relationship for the way Nixon, rather adeptly, I must say, handled a very temperamental one.
Well, you describe Charlie Chaplin as, quote, "the most prominent victim of the Red Scare." Why do you say that?
Well, most of the people who got blacklisted were screenwriters, a few producers, the occasional director. And nobody in Hollywood's ever cared about screenwriters, certainly. Producers and directors more so because they make more money and they have more power. But Charlie Chaplin was more than a screenwriter, more than a producer, and more than a director. He was all three of those things. He was also an autonomous filmmaker. He produced his own films. He financed his own films. He directed his own films. He composed the music score. He basically was a one-man picture factory. He didn't produce a lot. He only made a picture every 4 or 5 years in the period we're talking about. But the fact remains he was a very peculiar denizen of Hollywood in that he was not part of the studio system at all. He was part of the Charlie Chaplin system, and it was a factory of one. So he was outside the system at the same time he was inside the system in that he was highly respected, but nobody really knew him. He kept to himself in terms of the industry. He didn't go to a lot of parties. He wasn't particularly social. He was extraordinarily shy all his life. And he warmed up to very few people, and he needed very few people. So he was simultaneously part of the motion picture industry and completely apart from the motion picture industry.
Well, it was in 1952 that Charlie Chaplin left the United States for 20 years. Set the stage for us, Mr. Eyman, a little bit. What was going on in the world in 1952?
Well, in retrospect, it was basically the height of the blacklist era, the early 50s were the height of the blacklist era. Technically speaking, the blacklist era begins in 1947 with the congressional hearing into the Hollywood 10, as they were called. Which was a group of screenwriters, one or two directors, and a few producers. Congress knew who to call to constitute the Hollywood 10 because the FBI had the membership roster of the Communist Party. So they knew exactly who was in the party and who wasn't in the party. All the people that were components of the Hollywood 10 either were currently in the party as of 1947 or had been in the party and later resigned. So they could easily spring on them the question, are you now or have you ever been? When they knew the answer in advance. By 1952, most of the people that had been prosecuted, or if you prefer persecuted, were either unemployed in New York City, in Mexico. Some of them had gone to London in order to find work to survive. But they weren't working in the Hollywood film industry. Chaplin was still working, as it were, in the Hollywood film industry on his own picture. And they hadn't been able to lay a glove on him politically because, again, they had the roster and they knew that he'd never been a member of the Communist Party, had never donated money to the Communist Party, and was not, in fact, a communist. That said, they still regarded him as a threat to the Republic. So in 1952, he applied for a reentry permit because Chaplin was not a citizen. He'd never applied for citizenship. He was a resident alien. So whenever he left the country, he had to apply for a reentry permit. He was given his reentry permit by the INS, and he and his wife and their four children got on board the Queen Elizabeth in September of 1952 to go to London. He hadn't been out of the country at this point in 20 years, hadn't really had a vacation in 20 years. And he had a film opening, Limelight, his last film that he made in America. And he wanted to take his wife and show her his London, the London where he'd grown up in the 1890s and early 1900s, and introduce his children. And after the opening of Limelight in London, they were going to go on to Paris for the opening of the film in Paris, and then take a month or two of just sightseeing around Europe, and then they planned on returning to America. They got on board the Queen Elizabeth in September of 1952. One day out of New York, he got a telegram informing him that his reentry permit had been revoked. And that if he wanted to get back into the United States, he would have to face an investigation upon his return in New York City. This was a shot from deep left field. He hadn't seen it coming. Everything he owned was in America, California, his stocks, his bonds, his studio on La Brea Avenue, his film library, which is actually the most valuable thing he owned, his house, of course, everything. And he was in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. So it was a logistical crisis. It was a political crisis. It was an emotional crisis all at the same time for Chaplin. So that basically is what happened. But it took 10 years to come to fruition for the precedents that were established before they finally made a move to revoke his reentry.
And we'll get into some of those details in a minute, but the FBI had opened a file on Charlie Chaplin 30 years earlier in 1922. Why was mm-hmm. that?
He was regarded as insufficiently friendly to, he had attended socialist meetings in the aftermath of World War I. He was friends with a man, very good friends with a man named Max Eastman, an excellent writer who was a socialist at that point. Eastman's politics gradually migrated towards the center and then to the right. And I believe he ended up writing for William F. Buckley's National Review in the late 1950s, early 1960s. But he and Chaplin were friends. And so partially it was guilt by association. Partially it was Chaplin's insufficient enthusiasm for the presence of Will Hayes, who was the first czar of Hollywood, production czar of Hollywood, who could make censorship difficult for films that he didn't approve go right down the middle. In the early 1920s, there was a series of scandals in Hollywood. Fatty Arbuckle case, William Desmond Taylor murder, some drug issues, drug addiction issues. So the industry felt they had to clean their own house. And what could be better than to bring on a public figure of great respect and assumed probity? So they hired Will Hayes, who'd been Postmaster General in the Warren Harding administration. If the Harding administration is your idea of probity. But that's who they hired at six figures a year at a time when nobody was making six figures a year in Hollywood or anyplace else. But Hayes was the figure of clean up your act and censorship. And Chaplin didn't make films that required censors. His films were, generally speaking, beyond reproach when it came to that kind of thing. But he didn't like the idea of a government-mandated or corporate-mandated censorship over the film industry. He considered himself an artist, and he considered that artists should be free.
You write about Charlie Chaplin. He would frequently claim to be an anarchist, not in the bomb-throwing sense, but in a dislike of rules and a preference for as much liberty as the law allowed, and maybe just a bit more.
Emphatically, yes. He regarded himself, if to understand Charlie Chaplin, you have to understand his childhood, which took place in Victorian London in a theatrical background. His father was a singer of some renown who drank himself to death at the age of 37. His mother was also a music hall performer of less renown, who was diagnosed with syphilis and eventually went insane, spent years in an asylum. Chaplin and his half brother Sidney, were brought up essentially in workhouses and taught to read and write in workhouses. He had the equivalent of a fourth grade education, and for a time he lived on the streets. So essentially Chaplin had come to the hard knowledge that he couldn't really depend on any other human being other than himself and his brother Sidney, and he didn't trust a lot of people. And he wasn't emotionally close with a lot of people. And he simply held himself aloof from the sort of normal camaraderie that took place in show business circles in either England or America. He didn't really trust a lot of people. You can count them on one hand, basically, the people he trusted.
Scott Eyman, throughout your book, Charlie Chaplin versus America, you reference how the poverty of his youth affected Charlie Chaplin throughout his life.
Well, as I said, you can't understand Chaplin and he's an incredibly complex human being. And Chaplin's vision of his lost paradise was his childhood with his mother, because his father was gone very early. He had very fragmentary memories of his father. His mother, he adored. Everything about her. He knew the truth about her. I mean, he knew that she was hopelessly schizophrenic. He knew that she was syphilitic, and none of it made any difference. Whether she contracted the disease from her husband or other ways, we have no way of knowing, of course. But to her, she was his 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 ballast, his gravity, a vision of loveliness that he always held in his mind. So the sudden obliteration of that by her madness was a terribly destructive act. And as a result, he was, in a sense, his maturation, his emotional maturation was sliced off very early, I think. And as I said, he held himself aloof from the kind of what we regard as normal friendships and to an extent, sexual relationships.
You quote Charlie Chaplin as saying, to judge the morals of our family by commonplace standards would be as erroneous as putting a thermometer in boiling water. Scott Eiman, when he arrived in America in 1910, he was, quote, the most stunning rise of any 20th century performer. How did he achieve success so early?
I don't know that he ever fully understood it, because by the time he was 20, 21 years old, he was very successful in the theater. His days of want were over. But his mental image of himself and the focus of his emotional life was always on deprivation, the deprivation of his childhood. So he had this weird a duality about his consciousness. On the one hand, he became extraordinarily wealthy and extraordinarily famous. On the other hand, he essentially thought of himself as a deprived child. I'm sure a psychiatrist would nod their head and say, yes, exactly. That's exactly what happens with someone who has that kind of childhood and becomes and uses that as fuel, uses that as motivation to achieve, to get out of the squalor into which they were thrust. But I don't know that he ever had the distance that a professional psychiatrist or psychologist would. To him, it was a terrible trauma. And he struggled with it basically for the first half of his life, I think, until his last and successful marriage.
How did
which gave him the security and the emotional foundation that he'd always needed and desperately wanted.
And that, of course, was to Una, and we'll talk about her a little bit later. But how did the Little Tramp character evolve, and what did it represent?
Well, he was a success in vaudeville. As I mentioned, his days of want were over by the time he was 20 or 21. He was making a good living in the theater. And he played basically a comic drunk in the theater. That was his most famous act. And he was extremely successful. Stan Laurel was his understudy, later Laurel Hardy, of course. And Laurel told the most fascinating stories about him because they roomed together for several years with Chaplin and Laurel. And Laurel said people thought he was strange later on. He said they didn't understand. He was strange then. He didn't really mingle with the other actors, with the other comedians. He was kind of off by himself reading books. He wouldn't show up for the half hour before performance. And 10 minutes before the curtain rose, everybody would realize Chaplin's not here. Where's Charlie? Where's Charlie? Dear God, Charlie's not here. Stan, put on your makeup. And Laurel would slap on his makeup, and a couple minutes before the curtain was scheduled to rise, Chaplin would saunter in without a care in the world, put on his makeup, take his position, the curtain would rise, and he'd slaughter the audience. What I take this to mean is that he had absolute self-confidence in his professional skills. He didn't sweat, am I going to be good tonight? Are they going to love me? He didn't have the usual performer's anxiety. He understood that on some level, he had access to the audience. In a way that most actors don't. He was very successful in vaudeville. In 1912, Max Sennett saw him on stage and thought he was hilarious and made a mental note that the next time he had to hire a lead comedian, he'd hire Chaplin. So in 1913, he needed another lead comedian and he hired Chaplin for $175 a week, which is very good money in 1913. Initially, the contract on offer was for a year, but with a proviso that he could be let go with 2 weeks' notice. And Chaplin rejected that contract and held out for a full year no-cut contract, which Sennett grudgingly signed. So even at the age of 23, 24 years old, he's very sure of himself. He's very sure of his skill set. He's very sure of what that skill set can earn. him as a professional. He went to work for Senate, and Senate was stunned because on stage, Chaplin had made up to look much older than he was. He was 24 years old when he walked into Senate studio, and he played like a 40-year-old alcoholic. So Senate didn't know what he could do with him because he was very young. He was quite handsome. And he needed to do something other than the way he actually looked. So Senate told him to put on a funny makeup, throw something together. And as Chaplin told the story, and I have no doubt it's true, he went into the prop room, the costume department, and put together the costume for the tramp in something like 45 minutes. A pair of Fatty Arbuckle's pants, a derby hat, a little mustache to make him look older, because a mustache always makes people look old, a man look older. Oversized shoes. He made everything a contradiction. The coat was too tight. The shoes were too large. The hat almost fit. And he just sort of threw it together. And he went on stage, and they were shooting a film. And people started to laugh. And that was it. And he stuck with the character for the next 30 years.
Well, his fame grew so fast that he was able during World War I to sell World War I bonds. He founded United Artists with Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, D.W. Griffith. How many movies had he made by that point?
Well, in his first year at Keystone, he made over 30 movies, but they were one and two reelers. They were shorts. He didn't move into features until 1921. Until then, he was just making shorts. In 1921, he made his first feature, The Kid. And everybody had told him, you shouldn't do this. You're doing very well in shorts. You can make a couple shorts a year, whereas a feature will take you much longer and there's much more weight placed on it. And what if it's flops? You know, your career could come to a crashing halt. But he felt, he usually followed his instincts. He almost always followed his instincts. He placed great trust in instincts. And he thought that he needed to grow. And he couldn't grow the character without deepening the narratives, without deepening the situations in which the tramp was placed. And the kid, he basically put the tramp with a small child and gave the tramp the responsibility of raising a small child. And the tramp is actually a key transitional film in Chaplin's career. Because up to then, the tramp is kind of a two-legged irritant to society in general. He's not above pinching a girl. He's not above aggression. He's not above revenge. You know, he's kind of a creature from the id, actually. With the kid, where the tramp is forced to be care for more than a human being that he cares about more than he cares about himself, the character enters a transition. And there's a huge difference between the post-kid tramp and the pre-kid tramp. The post-kid tramp is much more concerned about saving other people than he is about saving himself. Whereas the pre-kid tramp is more concerned about saving himself.
Well, it was in 1940 that The Great Dictator movie came out, a high water mark for Charlie Chaplin. Quote from your book, for years, Chaplin had been reading about Hitler, watching newsreels about him, wondering about the resemblance. They were the same size, had the same mustache, and let's face it, a similar will to power. Besides that, they were born only 4 days apart. Is The Great Dictator an anti-Nazi film?
Overtly, from the moment he considered it. He never would have made it if it wasn't an anti-Nazi film, because it was an act of great political and psychological courage on his part. Nobody wanted the film made. Hollywood didn't want the film made because he started shooting the picture in September of 1939. Hollywood was not awash in anti-Nazi films at that point. They really didn't start producing anti-Nazi films for another year and a half. Certainly the American public was isolationist in 1939, as was Congress. And they would continue to be isolationist until the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in December 1941. So socially, he was swimming against the tide. Industrially, he was swimming against the tide because, as I said, the industry didn't want it made. The British Foreign Office didn't even want it made because Neville Chamberlain was in the Prime Minister's office, and he was attempting to placate Hitler politically and psychologically, and it wasn't working. Chaplin believed what Franklin Roosevelt believed. Chaplin believed what Winston Churchill believed. that you can't negotiate with an authoritarian psychotic. You can only defeat them or put them down like a mad dog. And the weapons that he had to work with were ridicule and satire. So those are the weapons he chose to use.
And in fact, at the end of the film, Charlie Chaplin broke character and gave a little speech. Here's part of it.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed.
Scott Eyman, what was the impact of that moment in the film?
Well, it was the first time the audience had heard Charlie Chaplin speak. His previous film had been Modern Times, which was a silent film made in 1936, and everybody thought he was crazy also because sound had obliterated silent films in the late 1920s. So he's making a silent film 10 years after silent films were dead. He sang a song at the end of Modern Times, but still nobody had heard him speak. So in The Great Dictator, there was a great deal of public fascination with what Charlie Chaplin sounded like. But he got over that very quickly because he plays two parts in the film. He plays Adenoid Hinkle, whose symbol is the double cross, the leader of Tomania, and he plays a Jewish barber. And as the Jewish barber, he speaks in quiet monosyllables. He really doesn't say much. He says, yes, well, maybe, I don't know, I'm not sure. But he doesn't really articulate anything. As Hinkle, he's kind of babbling in double talk all the time, Germanic double talk. So at the end of the movie, when he drops the veil and steps basically out of character as the Jewish barber and speaks as Charlie Chaplin, it was a moment of thunderous drama, really, because he's speaking not as an actor, he's speaking as a universally regarded figure of moral probity, as a spokesman for mankind. That's the substance of the speech. And he labored over that speech because the speech was always going to be the conclusion of the picture. He always knew it would end with a speech. And he began working on the speech basically when he began working on the film at the end of 1939. And the film did not come out until October of 1940. And finally, when it came in, he put it off and put it off and put it off, shooting the speech until very close to the end of the production. And he shot it very quickly. He shot six or eight takes over 2 days, and that was it.
FDR reached out to him after this film, right?
FDR reached out to him before the film. FDR, because there was a great deal of back and forth about should Chaplin make the film, will Chaplin make the film, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a letter in the book from Jack Warner to Chaplin. And Warner had just come out of a meeting in the Oval Office with Franklin Roosevelt. And Roosevelt had brought up Chaplin's film about dictators, and because there was all this publicity and anti-publicity in the papers about will Chaplin make it, won't Chaplin make it, should he make it, should he not make it. And the president told Jack Warner that he certainly hoped the film would be made and that he believed it would do a great deal of good. And Warner, in the letter, writes to Chaplin, giving him a pressie of the meeting with the president, and then ends by telling him, if the president thinks it's a good idea, I certainly hope you go ahead with this movie, Charlie. He did not offer to finance it. He did not offer to distribute it. But the Warner Brothers were, by this time, one of the few companies that were actively engaged in making anti-fascist films. So for a brief moment in Hollywood, they were on the same page as Chaplin. The Warner Brothers were on the same page as Chaplin, hence the supportive letter.
Scott Eyman, was The Great Dictator a commercial success?
It was a great commercial success all over the world. Remarkably so, because most of Europe was already fascist at that point. Basically, France was gone by the time the film opened. Italy was gone, Austria, Germany, of course. All that was left of most of Europe was England. But the film was extraordinarily successful in America and in England and everywhere else it played.
Was Charlie Chaplin Jewish?
No, he wasn't. But he was often accused of being Jewish by anti-Semites. And he never denied it because he thought it by denying it, he would be giving aid and comfort to the enemy by the implication that it was something not to embrace, you know. So he would simply let it pass, let those charges pass. But no, he had been regarded as Jewish since the early 1920s.
The subtitle of your book is When Art, Sex, and Politics Collide. It was in the 40s that he met a woman named Joan Barry. Who was she?
Joan Barry was a 22, 23-year-old girl. She had previously apparently been the mistress of J. Paul Getty in Oklahoma. She got it into her head that she should be in the movies. So she got a letter of introduction, went to Hollywood, met a few people. One of them was Charlie Chaplin. They struck up a relationship. It lasted slightly more than a year. Chaplin thought she had dramatic possibilities. He signed her to a contract. He bought a play for her that he was going to direct and make into a film starring her. Her behavior became increasingly erratic. She didn't show up for her acting lessons. He signed her up at Max Reinhardt's drama school in Hollywood, and she began cutting class. And Chaplin was very serious about work. You had to do the job. You had to learn your trade. And that put him off, as well as some of her erratic behavior put him off. They split up once, they split up twice. Finally, she went back to Oklahoma for a time, then came back to Hollywood and said she was pregnant and he was the father. And Chaplin did the math and he realized he couldn't possibly be the father. So he refused to make a settlement on her. She went to Hedda Hopper, who blew the story wide open, basically treating the pregnancy as a fait accompli for Chaplin. Chaplin knew it wasn't true. The government began a prosecution based on the Mann Act, which was a law passed in the early part of the century, banning taking women across state lines for immoral purposes. Essentially, it was to try to stamp out illegal prostitution. And they prosecuted him on that, and he was acquitted after the jury deliberated for an hour. Then came the paternity trial. Chaplin had willingly taken a blood test. The blood test proved he was not the father of the child, and Chaplin lost the case. The jury found against him. The reason they found against him was because at that point in California, we're talking 1943 now, a blood test was not dispositive. It wasn't dispositive until 1947 or 1948 in California. If the trial had taken place 5 years later, the blood test would have simply resulted in the dismissal of the case, and that would have been the end of it. But in 1943, the jury found against him, largely because of the portrayal of Chaplin in the media by people like Hedda Hopper and Ed Sullivan and Westbrook Pegler and other conservative columnists as an out-of-control libertine. So he lost the case. He appealed, and his appeal was turned down. So for the next 18 years, he had to pay child support for a child that wasn't his. At the same time the paternity suit was just getting underway, he married Una O'Neill, the daughter of Eugene O'Neill. She was 18, he was 54. The marriage, of course, would flourish. They'd have 8 children together and be idyllically happy for the rest of his life. But at the time, it seemed to be unspoken confirmation of the portrayal of him in the media as a libertine. And it probably worked against him in terms of the jury's decision to name him the father of the child.
The fact that Joan Barry reportedly had 2 abortions as well, did that play a role in the diminishment of Charlie Chaplin's reputation?
It was not widely printed. It never came up in the trial, because if it had come up in the trial, that would have opened up her sexual history. And her lawyers didn't want her sexual history examined terribly closely. So it didn't come up in the trial. It did come up in terms of the FBI's examination of her. She claimed that she had two abortions that Chaplin had paid for, but they never prosecuted him on that for reasons I can only guess at. It simply didn't come up at the trial. I have no doubt that it was a factor in their private deliberations about what to do with the Charlie Chaplin book, because they took her at her word, even though she later recanted almost all of her later testimony, all of her testimony 5, 6, 7 years later.
Scott Eyman, throughout this period, was J. Edgar Hoover following Charlie Chaplin's reputation and progress?
Like a bloodhound. Like a bloodhound. Hoover had a, I wouldn't say obsession, obsession's too strong a word. Let's say he had a very refined interest in Charlie Chaplin. Hoover's MO in regards to Chaplin was, he would, there would be a flurry of telegrams and telexes from Hoover to the Los Angeles FBI office. Please check out Charlie Chaplin. Please check out this thing about Charlie Chaplin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the LA office would basically do what he asked them to do. But as time went on, and then it would be all quiet on the Western Front for 9 months or a year. And then Hoover would get a bug again, and it would start all over, and the LA office would once again hurl themselves into the Charlie Chaplin business. And this went on, but as after World War II, the LA office got a little foot draggy because they'd been here before. They'd gone over, by this time, by 1946, 1947, basically the entire security apparatus of the United States of America had at one time or another gone into the Charlie Chaplin business. His mail was opened, his house was surveilled, his employees had been interviewed, his taxes, both corporate and personal, had been gone over with a fine-tooth comb. Basically, they were looking for something, anything, anything they could get him. And they didn't find anything. His taxes were, he paid more than his fair share. He never had any flaming radicals to the house, or very few flaming radicals to the house. They basically come up with nothing. So the LA office began dragging their heels because here we go again. And the LA office, and then Hoover would snap the leash. The LA office was run by a man named Richard Hood, who was very good and very well connected with the movie industry. Richard Hood's main source within the movie industry was Cecil B. DeMille. Cecil B. DeMille was one of Hood's special informants within Hollywood. And DeMille had been quizzed about Chaplin. And the interesting thing about DeMille's comments about Chaplin, he said, Chaplin is an artist. He's not particularly well-liked because he's regarded as cheap and because he doesn't mix. He's not part of the Hollywood community particularly. He's off by himself all the time. But DeMille, interestingly, never told Hood that he and Chaplin were kind of friendly. They weren't friends. I mean, they didn't go to parties together. They didn't play cards or anything like that. But DeMille had lent Chaplin his weekend getaway place called Paradise, which was up in the mountains way, way outside of LA on a couple of occasions. So they clearly knew each other and were friendly, if not friends. And DeMille did not tell Hood this. Interesting. But Hood basically began paying less and less attention to Charlie Chaplin because there were all these other authentic communists running around in California that they could easily get the goods on, you know, whereas he knew Chaplin essentially was not a communist, which was at that point the focus of Hoover's investigation.
So the Hedda Hoppers, the Walter Winchells, the Ed Sullivans, the American Legion, Cardinal Spellman, were they able to impact Charlie Chaplin's commercial success and his reputation?
Without question, without question. When you're looking at 10 years of disinformation, misinformation on a weekly / monthly basis, and most of which Chaplin did not respond, most of it he couldn't have responded to because it was a flood. It was a flood. He was pilloried for not being a citizen. I mean, America was full of people that weren't citizens that were living in New York and Los Angeles, especially in the movie industry. There are plenty of people in the movie industry that weren't citizens who were very successful. A lot of them were English. You know, they retained their English citizenship, but nobody pilloried them. You know, he was convenient because he was regarded as politically dicey, sexually dangerous. So he was singled out for the fact that he never became a citizen. Whereas California was full of people that weren't citizens, never a word was said about. So it was kind of selective persecution, if not selective prosecution.
You quote Charlie Chaplin in your book, "I dislike being told whom to kill and what to die for, and all in the name of patriotism. The fact is, I am no patriot, not for moral or intellectual reasons alone, but because I have no feeling for it. How can one tolerate patriotism when 6 million Jews were murdered in its name? Some might say that was in Germany. Nevertheless, those murderous cells lie dormant in every nation."
Yeah, that's as trenchant a statement as he ever made on the subject of his feelings about nationalism. His friend Max Eastman made a very good point, I thought. He said, Chaplin was born in England and became rich and famous in America, and he never became a citizen. He said what the people who hated Chaplin did not understand was that if he'd been born in America and become rich and famous in England, he wouldn't have taken out English citizenship either. He simply wouldn't have. As far as he was concerned, his national origin was a matter of accident, where you happen to be when your mother gives birth. It had nothing. He had no deep feelings. He had deep feelings for aspects of England, certain kinds of food, the atmosphere of Lambeth, where he grew up. You know, he was sentimental about certain things. But in terms of things like the monarchy, he was an anti-monarchist from the word go. He talked about once when he was a child, he couldn't cross the street because some royal personage in a carriage was driving by. So they were holding all the pedestrian traffic back. And he talked about how it enraged him that someone would have the right of way and ordinary people wouldn't be able to walk across the street. Well, that carried over. That carried over. He was an anti-monarchist in England, and he was not anti-American, but anti-knee-jerk patriotism in America. That's just the way he was. He was constructed that way, emotionally and psychologically.
Well, let's return to the seminal year of 1952. This is a quote. "Truman's Attorney General James McGranary's action was the culmination of years of a concerted campaign targeting the private sexual behavior and public political sympathies of the most dangerous brand of dissident, a beloved popular artist." What did Attorney General McGranary do?
McGranary, with Hoover's full support, rescinded Chaplin's reentry permit. Now, what Chaplin did not know at the time, as he was in the middle of the Atlantic after he got the telegram, was that a week after the reentry permit was canceled, the INS had a meeting. And they came to the very firm conclusion that if Chaplin came back and contested the rescindment of the reentry permit, they'd have to let him in the country because he'd never been convicted of a misdemeanor, let alone a felony. There was nothing. And generally, that was the vehicle by which the FBI would get rid of mafiosi that they didn't want. They'd have to convict Al Capone in tax evasion or Lucky Luciano in tax evasion, and then they could deport them. But they had to be convicted of a felony. Chaplin had never been convicted of anything. So they didn't have legal justification. Forget moral justification. They had no legal justification to kick him out of the country. And if he'd come back and forced a hearing, they would have had to let him back in the country. But Chaplin was furious. He was infuriated. He was livid for years about the banishment. And the last thing he was going to do was knock on the door and ask to be invited back to a party he'd been thrown out of. So he got to England, he opened his film, which turned out to be an enormous hit all over Europe, and had to figure out what to do with the rest of his life. No small decision when you're 63 years old. He probably figured he had another 10 or so years to go in that era. As it happened, he lived to the age of 88. He thought about moving to Italy. He thought briefly about England. His brother, Sidney, who he adored and trusted implicitly, he only really was close to two men in his life, his brother, Sidney, and Douglas Fairbanks Sr. And Doug Fairbanks died young at the age of 56 in 1939. And Chaplin never really had a best friend after Doug Fairbanks died. His closest male friend was his brother, Sidney. And Sidney suggested Switzerland or France. Sidney lived in Nice, generally. And he suggested Switzerland for tax reasons, because Sidney was paranoid about money. He was always coming up with wild schemes to avoid paying taxes. And he suggested Switzerland, and Chaplin hadn't really thought about it. He'd skied there. He knew the country slightly, but he'd never given any serious thought to moving anywhere other than Hollywood. So he thought about it, and just 4 or 5 months after the banishment, he bought a manor house in Vevey, and lived there for the rest of his life with his family.
So after Chaplin left the U.S. in 1952, what happened to his studio, to his holdings?
Well, the holdings, his money, his taxes, his bonds. One of the things I loved finding in my research in the Chaplin archives was a roster of his investments in 1952, his portfolio, his stock and bond portfolio. And it confirmed my suspicions. It's the sort of stock and bond portfolio that a Wall Street trader would have had in 1952.
And just quickly, there were U.S. savings bonds, there were defense bonds, stocks in AT&T, GE, Kodak, General Foods, R.J. Reynolds, Bank of America, Woolworths, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. True blue patriotic portfolio that would kick out 3% a year, 4% a year reliably. You know, lovely, absolutely professionally assembled portfolio. And tobacco companies, you know, which even at the time, and Chaplin didn't smoke. You know, the idea of him as some sort of radical leftist with a stock portfolio like that is hilarious. Anyway, everything he owned was in California. Luckily, his wife Una was a native born American. So she went back, closed out the investment accounts, brought them back with her. Some of the money, of course, could be wired. Some of the stuff could be wired over to Europe. That wasn't a problem. His brother basically handled the sale of the studio and the hardware within the studio, the camera booms, the cameras themselves, all the hardware you need to make movies. Sidney handled that. Sidney, when he wasn't living in Nice, would live sometimes in Palm Springs, sometimes in Florida. He had a trailer that he would travel around. Sidney would follow the sun wherever it was sun. He was a sun worshiper. And also an ardent nudist, not that it matters. But Sidney was an interesting, genuine eccentric. By comparison, Charlie was straight down the middle of the fairway, but Sidney was a fringe character in many respects. But it was a process that took some years. In 1955, the IRS came after him for back taxes based on his earnings from Limelight. Now, he'd been kicked out of the country in September of 1952, and they dunned him for money through 1954, which I think takes a certain amount of gall. there you have it. And he settled. They haggled for a while, and then he wrote a check for the taxes because he didn't want that hanging over them. All this is going on while he's resettling in Europe and Switzerland. The propaganda, the anti-Chaplin propaganda continued, and blatant lies were published. Just astonishing stories in the press. My two favorites were that he was conspiring with in Palestine with the Irgun, the Jewish radicals who were helping to found Israel, conspiring with Irgun to kill British soldiers in Palestine. That was around 1946, 1947, just as Israel was being founded. But the most insane one came after he'd left the country, when it was printed that he was going to adopt the children of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, which has been put to death for spying for Russia. And that one he actually, and there was another story, and these are just typical examples of propaganda, anti-Chaplin propaganda. There was another story that was printed in a Sunday magazine, nationwide Sunday magazine, that he had furloughed all of his studio employees that had been with him for 30 years without severance, which is also a blatant lie. He laid out almost $80,000 in severance for the employees at his studio. And again, he didn't bother to deny these stories, except the ones about the one about Julius and Ethel Rosenberg's children that he bothered to issue a public statement about. But it was like being caught in a hurricane that lifts Dorothy up and transports her to Oz. You know, they created an image of Chaplin that had very little relation to who he actually was as a man or as an artist.
But Scott Eyman, at the height of the Cold War, Charlie Chaplin toured Russia, didn't he, and met with Nikita Khrushchev?
He never went to Russia in his life. No, he met Khrushchev someplace. I don't remember where. It might have been Paris, but he never went to Russia in his life.
But then you quote him as saying, "I am not a communist, but I feel proud to say that I feel pretty pro-communist. I don't want radical change. I want an evolutionary change. I don't want to go back to the days of 1929. I don't want to go back to a sick and crazy world like the one we had and which produced Hitler and Hitlerism."
The Depression. In 1931, he took a trip. He hadn't been out of the country. He took vacations every 10 years, basically. He hadn't been, in 1931, he left for London to promote City Lights, his film City Lights. And he kept going. He was gone for 18 months. And he went around the world several times. Places he'd never been, places he would never go again. He went to Bali, for God's sakes. Out of the way places. And it was a transcendent experience for him, because he experienced completely different populations, completely different cultures. But almost everywhere he went, he saw the results of the deprivation of the Depression, which was 2 and 3 years old. He didn't come back until 1933. He was gone for 18 months. So the Depression was well underway at this point, and it wasn't close to coming out of it. The Depression didn't start easing until, 34, 35. And he saw it at its worst. And it really firmed up his feelings about nationalism and economies and what people should have in times of deprivation. Essentially, he had a kind of utopian socialist bent. He thought poor people should be able to walk into a store, pick up the food they need, and walk out. That was his idea. And he would, after he left the country, he would go, he would stop in England once in a while and visit friends. And Graham Greene, the novelist, had reviewed his films when Graham Greene was a movie critic, and they knew each other slightly because they hung around with the same social group. And Green, whose politics were fairly left, would often walk out because he couldn't stand to hear Chaplin talking such ridiculous rubbish, because he thought that it was just utopian rubbish, that was never going to happen on the face of the earth, that poor people could walk into stores and walk out with whatever they wanted. And he thought Chaplin was simply being naive, which indeed he was. But that was what, again, returning to Chaplin's childhood, that was what his vendetta is too strong a word, his grudge, shall we say, against the English social welfare system had led him to.
Well, it was 20 years after Charlie Chaplin left American soil that he returned. Here he is on April 10th, 1972.
Thank you for the honor of inviting me here. And, oh, you're wonderful, sweet people. Thank you.
Scott Eiman, what are we seeing there?
That's Chaplin's acceptance speech for his Honorary Academy Award in 1972. When he was kicked out of the country in 1952, precisely three people had stood up for him publicly and said this was a terrible, terrible thing that just happened. Sam Goldwyn, William Wyler, and Cary Grant. Those were the only three people in the Hollywood A-list who stood up for Charlie Chaplin. Everybody else kept their heads down. They didn't want to be associated with him. They didn't want to stand up for him. So essentially, it was a time of moral, the time of the toad, as Dalton Trumbull would say. It was a time of great moral cowardice because nobody wanted to be branded as sympathetic to someone that was regarded as un-American in 1952. 20 years later, when it was safe, they all realized, oh, we made a slight error of judgment here. So they gave him a slight, an honorary Academy Award because basically as a way of saying, we're sorry. And he agreed to accept it. The odd thing was, as his son, Sidney, he named his son Sidney after his brother. His son Sidney told me he didn't care about awards. He never cared about it. Awards meant nothing to him. He cared about the dailiness of the job. He cared about working on a script until it was as good as he possibly could make it, about working on a scene until it was as good as he could possibly make it, about working on the film until it was as good as he possibly making it. It was all about being a good workman to him. That was his identity. It wasn't as some guy on a mountaintop dispensing wisdom. It was the dailiness of being a good workman. And he said he really didn't care about awards. But the ovation, the fact of coming back to California that he hadn't seen in 20 years, and the huge, huge change, as he said to his wife, Una, it's nothing but banks, banks, banks.
And we should note that in 1972, of course, Richard Nixon was the president of the United States.
And Nixon didn't say a thing about Chaplin coming back to America and getting an honorary Oscar. Hedda Hopper was dead back then, by then, and he wasn't going. He didn't have to worry about being harangued by her.
How long did Chaplin stay in the country?
A week. He came to New York. He got the Handel Medallion from the city of New York. First, they came to the Bahamas so he could get used to the time change, because at this point, he's 83 years old, and old age is beginning to have its effect on him. He's not the same person he was in 1952. He slowed up considerably. So he had to be kind of handled carefully. They went to the Bahamas for a couple days to get him used to the time change. Then they went to New York for a couple days. And then they went to L.A. for the Oscar ceremony. And then he went back home and never came back to America.
Partial filmography of Charlie Chaplin's in 1915, The Tramp, followed by The Kid, The Gold Rush, City Lights, Modern Times in 1936, The Great Dictator in 40, Limelight, and A King in New York came out in 1957 while he was living abroad. Scott Eiman, if you were to recommend one of those movies for somebody to get a sense of Charlie Chaplin, which one?
One movie, Modern Times. Because the essence of Chaplin is his connection to the real world. There are a lot of comedians who want to take the audience away from the real world, especially in Chaplin's time there were. But Chaplin was connected to the real world that people saw walking to the theater. They saw poor people, they saw stores, they saw factories, they saw an increasingly industrialized America. And Modern Times is his take on that reality that was pandemic in the 1930s. And it hasn't changed any, except it's more so now than it was in 1936. So I think it's one of those films that's eternally relevant, as is The Great Dictator.
Scott Eiman has written about Cary Grant, Louis B. Mayer, Mary Pickford, John Ford, Cecil B. DeMille, John Wayne, and some others. It sounds like you got pretty good cooperation from the Chaplin family for this book.
They gave me free rein. They asked for no permissions at all. They never saw the manuscript. I wrote what I wrote based on what I found. I was very pleased. I expected them to be more, to hover far more than they did. There was no hovering whatsoever. They gave me permission to do my research in their archives without holding anything back and write what I chose.
Charlie Chaplin versus America, When Art, Sex, and Politics Collide. Scott Eiman, thank you for spending an hour discussing it with us.
Thank you. Take care now.
All Q&A programs are available on our website or as a podcast on our C-SPAN Now app.